The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard every Sunday from 1 to 2 here on KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon. We stream worldwide at korcfm.com, where you can make a secure online donation. And if you would like to help us report the news, this is a collective effort of the community that happens every week. We welcome you to reach out to us, info@korcfm.com, and let's talk about the possibilities, of which there are many. On this week's program, we've got news on a Wolverine sighting put together by our own Explorin' Lauren. We have an update on the debacle surrounding Counselor Charlene Ellis by Nick Martin. We also have the week's city meetings, an interview with the county administrator, Rachel McEnany, and some other information pertinent to Corvallis coming up this hour on KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of March 25th, 2024. On Tuesday, March 26th at 4:30 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board CAB meeting will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, March 27th at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. A federal judge in Eugene has halted the proceedings to oust Corvallis Ward 5 Counselor Charlene Ellis. Judge Ann Aiken granted Ellis a preliminary injunction on her case, stopping it for now. According to the Gazette Times, quote, Judge Aiken's formal written order is not available yet in court findings, but she did issue a minute order, which is a quick answer to a party's motion. Ellis was seeking to enjoin the city from holding the due process hearing, adopting a resolution against her, and also from enforcing the section of the city charter she is challenging against her, or anyone else. It's not clear from the minute order which or if all of the requests were granted, unquote. As we've reported before, Counselor Ellis is being accused of violating the city charter. The allegation stems from comments she made during a September 18th council meeting, in which she made a motion to direct City Manager Mark Shepard to post a job opening for a climate specialist for the Climate Action Advisory Board, or CAB. It was this proposed motion that got her into trouble. Here is her making the motion.
Is that the Climate Action Advisory Board requests that the council direct the city manager to post the full-time job position of climate program specialist within 2 weeks and provide an update on the hiring process every meeting until filled.
So what exactly is Councillor Ellis accused of? According to a resolution intended to be presented at the December 4th council meeting, her actions at both the September 13th meeting and the subsequent September 18th city council meeting violated Section 23, subsection F of the Charter, which refers to interference in administration and elections. The section states, quote, neither the mayor nor any member of the council shall in any manner, directly or indirectly, by suggestion or otherwise, attempt to influence or coerce the manager in the making of any appointment or removal of any officer or employee. A violation of the foregoing provisions of this section shall forfeit the office of the offender. For some background, the Climate Action Advisory Board is a body tasked with helping Corvallis meet the greenhouse gas emissions target set forth in the Corvallis Climate Action Plan and to make policy recommendations to the City Council in that regard when needed. Councillor Ellis both chairs the group as well as acts as council liaison. The group utilizes the skills of a climate specialist to help with meeting operations, as well as work to secure funds related to climate initiatives, among other things. Two people previously holding this position had since left, leaving a gap. It was this gap the board discussed at that September 13th CAB meeting. Fearing the advisory board would not be able to continue meeting due to this vacancy, a motion was passed to bring this vacancy-filling request to the next city council meeting. Fast forward to that city council meeting on the 18th, where Ellis made her motion we heard earlier. It is those two moments that are the focus of the accusations. This is Nick Martin with KORC.
In February, a rare wildlife sighting was made about 50 miles northeast of Corvallis, which excited biologists and wildlife lovers. As it crossed a field near Highway 99 and Barlow, Oregonians caught a glimpse of the wolverine. This follows another wolverine sighting on the Columbia River in 2023, stunning biologists who had previously thought their range in Oregon to be limited to the Wallowa Mountains in the northeast. Less than 300 wolverines are thought to inhabit the lower 48 in the United States, and as of 2023, the American wolverine is officially listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act of 1973. A small population exists in the northern Cascades of Washington, and outside of the Wallowas, the last documented wolverine in Oregon was a roadkill incident near Hood River in 1990. Oregon's wolverine population is thought to be one of the southernmost on the planet. Fossil and genetic evidence indicate that North American wolverines evolved from a population in Beringia during the last ice age. That's the region north of the Bering Sea, comprising what is now northeastern Russia and the U.S. state of Alaska. They're part of a family of mostly carnivorous mammals called the mustelids, which includes martens, otters, badgers, and weasels. Their thick, oily fur is hydrophobic, making it resistant to frost in the alpine regions they inhabit. While only the size of a medium dog, wolverines can be fierce predators, taking on prey many times their size, such as moose or elk. Primarily, they either scavenge or prey on small mammals such as rodents. In fact, like other mustelids, wolverines have evolved a special upper molar in the back of the mouth that's rotated 90 degrees and allows them to tear off meat that has frozen solid. Their scavenging skills are impressive. Learning to follow predator trails to their kills or seeking out trapped animals and supplementing their diet with food such as bird eggs, roots, insects, and berries. Gray wolves and cougars are the major natural predators to wolverines, and in the wild, the wolverine lifespan is probably about 8 to 10 years, although the life cycle of these elusive animals is still under study. While wolverines are generally solitary individuals, male wolverines are polygamous, forming lifetime relationships with two or three females. Summer is mating season, but females store the embryos until early winter, and their bodies can stop gestation if food is scarce. One or two kits will be born in the early spring and usually leave their den in May. Female wolverines need deep snow, about 5 to 7 feet, to build their birthing dens away from predators and from the cold winters. At our latitude in Oregon, that means their territory is restricted to high mountain forests in the Cascades with late spring snowmelts. It also means that our timber industry and earlier snowmelts from a warming climate continue to fragment and threaten North American wolverine populations in Oregon. While it's thrilling to have more sightings of these amazing mammals, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife reminds us that the individual spotted in February was probably dispersing because its habitat was unsuitable. Wolverines have been known to travel up to 30 miles per day, but the ODFW still set several baited hair collection devices in the area of the sighting in the slim chance that a DNA sample could be collected and compared to an existing database. current and future Wolverine populations will thrive in Oregon, it will be because of a conscious effort on the part of Oregonians and the federal government to regulate the timber industry and other types of human development so that their crucial alpine habitats are preserved to suit their life cycle. These fierce and majestic creatures have wandered our region for over 2 million years, long before Euro-American settlement and the ceaseless, rampant extraction of natural resources for industry and private profit. Now their very existence is threatened by human activities, and it's our responsibility to balance our relationship with native ecosystems and the biosphere itself. Even the global project of transitioning to renewable energy sources and reducing greenhouse gases will not stop the destruction and fragmentation of habitats like the wolverines and countless other creatures we share this land with. But it isn't too late. Everyone can help prioritize wildlife conservation in our region by getting involved in habitat restoration and protection, spreading awareness and education about native ecosystems, advocating and practicing sustainable land use, and perhaps most impactfully, pressuring regional and state representatives with a mandate to conserve and restore native habitats with the power of the state and federal governments. Together, we can protect Oregon's precious wildlife, such as the wolverine, so that our descendants can revel in the beauty of theirs. Thank you for considering our native species.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. KORC features segments of Democracy Now!, so you can obtain national and international news during this segment. For more information, go to democracynow.org.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The need for an immediate, sustained ceasefire with the release of hostages. That would create space to surge more humanitarian assistance, to relieve the suffering of many people, and to build something more enduring.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in Israel as the U.S. for the first time introduces a U.N. Security Council resolution supporting a ceasefire in Gaza after months of vetoing other ceasefire calls. Then to the Goon Squad. Six white law enforcement officers in Mississippi have been sentenced to up to 40 years in prison for torturing two black men, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker.
This is a history-making moment. I'm just so sorry it had to come on the backs of the pain and the suffering, the torture and the shooting and the abuse and waterboarding of Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, our clients.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing its relentless assault on the Gaza Strip, with deaths reported earlier today in residential areas of Gaza City, Rafah and Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, the deadly raid on Al-Shifa Hospital is in its fifth day. Israeli soldiers have killed at least 140 people at Al-Shifa. Journalists and medical staff have been blindfolded and forced to strip naked. At least 13 patients have died in recent days due to a lack of medical treatment. Israeli forces ordered thousands of patients, staff, and displaced people sheltering at the hospital to evacuate as they threatened to blow up the entire facility. Families who were already displaced and are once again on the move describe their brutal eviction from Al-Shifa.
We were surprised that at 2 a.m. there was shelling. The children were terrified. What more can I tell you? We stayed until the morning. We were not allowed to go down or up. They were calling with the loudspeakers from downstairs for men to prepare themselves, that the emergency team should prepare itself. The court outside with the bulldozers, the tanks, they turned things upside down. I don't know what more to tell you. The children were terrified. They turned things upside down in Al-Shifa, in the area of Al-Shifa. They didn't care about a child or a pregnant woman or youth or anything.
Al Jazeera has shared video that appears to show an Israeli drone targeting, then launching an air attack on a group of at least four unarmed civilians as they were walking in an open area of Khan Yunis in Gaza. One young man who survived the first bombing attempts to leave the scene before being killed in another strike. The shocking video is said to date back to February, but was released on Thursday. This all comes as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken held a meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv today and is meeting with other Israeli officials in the War Cabinet. The U.S. is now pushing for a ceasefire deal in exchange for the release of hostages. Blinken just wrapped up meetings with Arab leaders in Saudi Arabia and Cairo, Egypt, where he said, quote, children should not be dying of malnutrition in Gaza, adding, quote, 100% of the population of Gaza is experiencing severe levels of acute food insecurity, Blinken said. The head of Israel's Mossad spy agency is meeting with CIA Director William Burns and Egyptian counterparts for talks around ceasefire in Qatar. Meanwhile, over 70 former U.S. diplomats, government military officials have urged President Biden to warn Israel against building illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and denying Palestinian rights. The officials, which include Clinton National Security Advisor Anthony Lake and other White House, Pentagon and State Department diplomats, say the U.S. should be prepared to withhold assistance to Israel. Israel's killed at least 430 Palestinians in the West Bank since October 7th, including 10 people Thursday alone. Among those killed yesterday was a 19-year-old teenager and a 63-year-old man who converted to Judaism but was reportedly, quote, mistakenly shot. Israeli forces have detained over 7,300 West Bank Palestinians since October 7th. UN officials continue to sound the alarm over the humanitarian crisis in Sudan, which they've described as one of the worst in recent history. The UN Security Council met Wednesday to discuss the conflict as it nears the one-year mark since fighting broke out between the Sudanese military and rival rapid support forces. Edem Wasornu, the director of operations for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, warns Sudan is possibly on course to become the world's worst hunger crisis.
Malnutrition is soaring to alarming levels and is already claiming children's lives. A recent MSF report revealed that one child is dying every 2 hours in Zamzam camp in El Fasher, North Darfur. Our humanitarian partners estimate that in the coming weeks and months, somewhere in the region of around 222,000 children could die from malnutrition. And with the estimated WHO estimates that more than 70% of health facilities are not functional.
In Haiti, armed groups have launched new attacks and blockades in the suburbs near Port-au-Prince, with multiple deaths reported. Haitian police say an operation killed the head of Delma 95, Ernst Julma, known as Tigre. Delma 95 is part of Jimmy Charissier's alliance of armed groups. The U.S. State Department Wednesday confirmed it had completed the first evacuation of more than 15 U.S. citizens from Port-au-Prince. Florida officials also chartered a plane to evacuate over a dozen residents of Florida from Haiti Wednesday. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has warned he'll block the entry of undocumented Haitian immigrants into Florida and threatened to fly any undocumented Haitians who arrive in Florida to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. This comes as dozens of Congress members are urging the Biden administration to stop deportations to Haiti due to the worsening violence and instability and to extend temporary protected status, TPS, for Haitians. Over 70 Rohingya refugees are believed to be dead or missing after their boat capsized off the coast of Indonesia's Aceh province. At least 75 others have been rescued as of Friday. More than 2,300 Rohingya refugees fleeing persecution in Burma arrived in Indonesia last year, while hundreds of others have died or disappeared after attempting to leave Burma or Bangladesh. French lawmakers advanced a bill that seeks to rein in fast fashion's impact on the climate, labor rights, and the economy. The bill would ban certain ultra-fast fashion companies like Shein from advertising and penalize them by up to 10 euros per individual item of clothing. It also would force fast fashion retailers to include information on their products' reuse, repair, recycling, and environmental impact next to the product's price. This is French lawmaker Huguette Tienya.
Fighting fast fashion means, first, protecting children living in other countries. It means preserving our biodiversity. It means preserving our French know-how. It means preserving our artisans who work hard day and night in our districts to create clothes that are sustainable and that comply with a minimum of environmental rules.
Russia launched a massive attack on Ukraine's energy system overnight, killing three people, leaving 1 million people without power. The attacks triggered a fire at the Dnipro hydroelectric station, cutting off power to the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, but authorities said there was no risk of a breach. This comes just one day after U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan visited Kiev, the Ukrainian capital. Back in the U.S., the Justice Department has filed a sweeping antitrust lawsuit against Apple, accusing the tech giant of orchestrating an illegal monopoly in the smartphone industry. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the suit Thursday.
Apple carries out its exclusionary anti-competitive conduct in two principal ways. First, Apple imposes contractual restrictions and fees that limit the features and functionality that developers can offer iPhone users. Second, Apple selectively restricts access to the points of connection between third-party apps and the iPhone's operating system, degrading the functionality of non-Apple apps and accessories. As a result, for most of the past 15 years, Apple has collected a tax in the form of a 30% commission on the price of any app downloaded from the App Store, as well as on in-app purchases.
In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed a new law banning unhoused people from sleeping in public places such as parks and sidewalks. The law requires counties to establish temporary campsites if shelters are at maximum capacity. Under the law, individuals can sue a jurisdiction if they see people living on the streets. Housing advocates and other critics say the law does not effectively address the housing crisis or provide necessary funding and further marginalizes the already vulnerable unhoused population. Here in New York, home health aides are on a five-day hunger strike, calling on the city to pass the No More 24 Act to put an end to 24-hour workdays. The majority of home health workers are women of color and immigrant women. Gui Hua Song from the Chinese Staff and Workers Association said, quote, working 24 hours a day for a long time, our bodies have been tortured, broken down, and full of aches and pains. We cannot care for our children and families. Many of our sisters' health is destroyed, and they, too, have become pain. Patience, they said. In more labor news, Georgia Republicans passed a bill that penalizes union-friendly employers. The legislation would bar workplaces that voluntarily recognize unions from receiving state subsidies. Republican Governor Brian Kemp backs the law, but it's expected to face tough legal challenges. The president of the AFL-CIO, Liz Schuler, called the measure appalling, adding that it, quote, violates long-held precedent established by the National Labor Relations Board. Act. And Senator Bernie Sanders and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez reintroduced the Green New Deal for Public Housing Act this week to address the dual crises of climate change and unaffordable housing. This is AOC.
Green New Deal for Public Housing would immediately replenish the multi-billion dollar backlog for public housing repairs. It would repeal the Fair Cloth Amendment. It would invest up to $234 billion over 10 years to preserve, upgrade, and expand our public housing stock. It would bring public housing down to zero carbon emissions while creating 280,000 jobs in America.
Yeah.
It would end the era of government neglect, demolition, and privatization of our public housing stock. This bill also addresses unsustainable rent prices.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
يلا تنام لا تبح لا طير الحمام روح يا حمام لا
Go to sleep, Rima, by Feruz. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
That was Democracy Now! On KORC, News, Music, and Civics. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org.
This is Dan Kroll, walking on Flat Mountain, and I'm with Rachel McEnany, who is the new Benton County Administrator as of this past October. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. We're walking through the snow right now.
That's actual snow.
Which is something that I miss from being from upstate New York. I've been missing seeing the snow.
It's early March of 2024, and we are at an elevation probably close to about 900 feet. So there is snow on the ground, whereas the rest of the valley, much of Benton County, it's kind of a spring day.
It is. It's beautiful out today. Absolutely beautiful.
Not many clouds in the sky. And we are just getting out to show Rachel, who is a new resident, again, as of October, a new resident of Oregon. And what better places to see than our natural features?
Yeah. And we brought my dog, and he is just absolutely amazed and running through the snow, and it's leaping and dreaming, and it's just a beautiful day today.
What kind of a dog do you have?
I have an Australian Shepherd.
What's his name?
His name is Jaeger, but the Y-A-E-G-R after Chuck Jaeger, who was the speed of sound, a very famous pilot. I thought the dog was very fast, so that's how he got his name.
He's coming up to us right now. We are walking on a forest road, and we want to just get to know Rachel and what she's interested in, because as a county administrator, she certainly has responsibilities, which we'll talk about a little bit, but outside of work, we know that we all have our unique interests, our background, our life experiences that have made us who we are today, and Rachel has quite a background working with names you might recognize. In the 90s, when you were going to college, what did you go to college for?
I have a theater degree, and so I worked along a lot of folks who are still working in the industry. We used to work in a coffee shop improv group, which also Jimmy Fallon was part of as well. So
Jimmy Fallon,
yeah.
The TV host and
yes.
Saturday Night Live
guy?
Yeah,
he was a creator back then, always funny. Always wanting to go for the joke and do that type of work. He did not graduate with us, but
you all were the same age?
We're all the same age, yes. We're all from upstate New York, so we all moved to New York City around the same time, and we all were working in different areas of the industry.
And from what I understand, you helped found a theater company in Brooklyn that is still operating to this day.
Yeah, it is. It's called Piper Theater Productions. My brother John is the artistic director. It was something I'm really proud of to create something along those lines. And not only do we take professional shows to performing free theater in Brooklyn, everything is free and accessible to everyone, but we also probably train about 200 to 300 kids in the summer in theater, and they have gone on to careers. One of the more famous person would be Jeremy Ayers, who's on the Cho, the bear. So he is a longtime committed person to Piper. And we've seen these kids go on and have really nice careers, and they're ready for their bachelor's and their master's to go into theater. And yeah, it's a wonderful program.
And when was the theater officially founded?
2001. We finished our first season, and then September 11th came through, and we shifted as a theater company, and we actually produced a fundraiser that was covered by the New York Times and with some friends. We worked with New York City firefighters, and they actually performed in a play to kind of keep the theater company coming and going. So it's a really, really wonderful program, and we do most of our work in the summers.
Do you feel like because of the tragic nature of 9/11 that may have boosted people's interest to get involved in something like a community theater organization?
Well, I think everything in the arts is based in community, and you know, it is about building communities. So being able to work alongside maybe someone who's trying to be a professional actor but then is also a professional firefighter, or is, you know, a young Latino kid who is in the apprenticeship program, and they're all on stage together. Yes, there's a mismatch of talent, but at the same time, it's so accessible. It also really brings more people out to watch it. The more you work with people in the community, more butts in seats. And so I truly feel like that's why Piper has been so successful, because we have such a commitment to the community.
So you have a background in theater, and you yourself are an actress.
I have been. I haven't really performed a lot. I have seen some local theater here. I've also gone up to Portland, and I will say this, and this is not being a snob, I've seen better theater locally in Albany and Corvallis than I had seen in Portland. So kudos to your local theater, because the work they're doing here is strong.
I have meant to get down to some of the theater productions over in Albany at the Albany Civic Theater. Is that who you've seen?
Yeah, I've been to Albany Civic Theater, and I've also been to the local Corvallis Theater, the Majestic, and I've seen two shows there, and once again, really, really strong productions. And I really want to get over to OSU as well and see their theater department as well.
I know the high schools have, or at least Corvallis High School has a theater company that's been going strong for quite some time.
Yep. So, and you know, arts organizations have ebbs and flows. There's good seasons and bad seasons. But that's what's wonderful about the arts is, you know, it's not about just throwing something up against the wall and seeing if it sticks, but it continues to challenge the community with different programming. And I'm seeing that here, that they're willing to kind of look at social justice issues and do some uncharacteristic casting choices, and that's smart. It's smart, it's sharp, it's challenging local audiences, and, you know, it's hey, I just got here. I got to see a full season. So,
so in addition to your work and background in theater,
yeah.
I understand you've had a number of positions working with political figures.
Yep. So my first kind of foray into like politics was running a congressional campaign, and that was really exciting. I also look at campaigns very similar to like theater. Because in a political campaign, you have a certain amount of time to tell your story, and then you have one opening night, and that's election night. So it has the same, a lot of experience. You work with a lot of volunteers, and that's a lot where community theater comes in as well, is that you're getting a lot of people in the community to come in together, get behind a candidate, tell their story, see if those issues matter, and then you have one night, and it could be your closing night. So that that's kind of where I like the election piece. So from there, I was hired, and I've worked for a district attorney who had some very high-profile cases, and then I went to work for an elected official named Kirsten Gillibrand, and Kirsten is the one of two New York senators for the state of New York, and she was appointed when Hillary Clinton became the she went to the State Department when Barack Obama was elected, and then I stayed with Kirsten for about 6 years, and then I moved over and I started working for Governor Andrew Cuomo, and I was his Deputy Commissioner for Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and I came in at the tail end of the storms of Irene and Lee and moved right into Superstorm Sandy. And that was an incredibly intensive time. I think I was away from my family for about 5 months.
What were your responsibilities during that?
I ran the FEMA operation of recovery. And then during the actual activation, I was I wrote probably about 400 press releases for the governor, as well as deployed all resources like generators and other needs to the area. That particular storm had a lot to do with liaising with the grid, because a lot of the power went off and there was a lot of flooding. So I was also the individual connected to the New York City EOC, and I was also in charge of building an emergency operations center in New York City. So it was a lot. It was long days. And finally, I was moved over to the Labor Department, and I worked there for about 5 years. And then I went to go, the mayor of Albany, New York, came to me to talk to me. And I wanted to get into local government, and because I kind of got a little bored in the state Labor Department. So I went, we had a cup of tea at my dining room table, and we started talking about the budget and some struggles. She was a new mayor. She was the first female mayor of Albany. Albany has had 3 mayors in 100 years. They don't change their...
Oh, so no term limits.
No, and it's a strong mayor form of government, which is different from out here. And I basically came in and was her number 2, which is kind of similar to the structure in the city of Corvallis in some ways, but... and I ran the day-to-day operations of the administration and made a lot of the key hires to the mayor, created the first diversity program that existed, modernized the city. When I came in, they didn't have cell phones. They had big monitors on their desks. We did not have what's called an ERP system. So I had to do a lot of the IT infrastructure. And then we also went through a nationally known ransomware attack, which I was able to go down to the Atlantic and talk about it in D.C. And that is a huge problem for all public entities, is a cyber attack. Because as we get more and more dependent on technology, the risk is there on lots of levels. And especially from a public safety standpoint, because I believe government needs to exist on a very simple level, is that we need to be there for people who are in need. Despite all the other wonderful things that we do in the county, we need to respond to people in emergencies. And that's kind of where I fundamentally believe that we have to be first. We always have to be first there. And the thing about cyber attacks is it does affect our technology. It can affect our traffic lights. It can affect, of course, our purchasing and payroll issues to be able to pay people. But it really, that communication key is really important. And that's why it's so important that Benton County continues to ask for funding for, you know, radio and communication issues. Because we need all of our public service areas to be able to talk to one another. And we saw that in the recent ice storm when I was here. So, that's got to be and continue needs to be a priority in government.
We're speaking right now with Rachel McEnany, who is the county administrator of Benton County. She was hired in October of 2023. She has quite a background. She has moved out from New York just for this job. You came across the country.
I did.
How do you like it out here so far?
Well, it's beautiful. It reminds me a lot of Ireland, to be honest with you. I had actually gone to Ireland in June. I've been about 5 or 6 times to Ireland. And it really reminds me a lot of the topography. I also, what drew me to this area was the rounds and rounds of interviews that I had with community members and people who worked, and the folks who worked at Benton County. And I just saw that they were really welcoming. They were interested in change. They were interested in some of my ideas and change management. I think they also really respected that I know in government things take time. Things can get slow. And I'm really just kind of honored that they went with a candidate, because they had other candidates who were from here, and they took a chance on me. And, you know, I'm really hoping that I can provide a vision and some leadership and a direction that reflects the community.
Mm-hmm.
lots of parts to being a county administrator. My day-to-day job is so different every day, and that's what really intrigues me, because I'm never bored. I'm always learning something new. And there's like a lot of components to a county administrator. So first you have to, it's not a very sexy title, but a county administrator, first of all, we have to administer these day-to-day functions and business needs every single day that needs to happen. And in my role, I have to support those departments, whether it's a health department, community development, a sustainability coordinator. Where are we going with DEI, right? Diversity, equity, inclusion. Is the IT department fully staffed, and do they have all the tools they need to be successful? Are our public works being responsive and filling potholes and looking at our bridges and keeping us safe? Is our sheriff's department, do they have everything they need? So that's part of being a county administrator. And then there's kind of helping setting the policy with the three commissioners, the three elected officials, and really, really finding out their priorities and how they align with the community, because the commissioners are very, very close to the community. So their feedback is so, so important to where we need and where we need to go. Things changed entirely after the pandemic. The organization changed. The workforce changed. So one of my personal priorities is to be a workplace of choice. One is we are finishing up a market study that really shows that, you know, we do not pay our managers enough. And then we're also right now in a union negotiation, really, really important, right? I come from an organization. My last job had 13 collective bargaining units, 13 different ways of how people work. So I have that ability and respect for union work and the back-breaking work that they do every year. And remember, I have nurses. I have public workers. I have sheriff deputies. They're all very, very different. To come up with one simple policy like everybody can work 50% of their time home in their office, is that fair to the constituency that needs to get a dog license or wants to get married that day? Or wants to pay their property tax bill? So the balance, I have to think of the whole county. So even like you take an ice storm, for example, and we kept closing and closing. That was more days that people couldn't get to get their meds. So we had to open, right? So those are the type of things I try to balance every day with decision making. So it's I love what I'm doing. I absolutely love what I do. I love the people I'm working with. And now it's really, I'm starting to get out to the city managers of Monroe and Albany and Adair Village and even some unaffiliated places like LC and learning about rural health and work like that. I don't have a background in that area, and I don't have a strong background in our those who are unhoused and looking at the homeless issue. And you guys have been at the forefront of this issue, and I wanted to learn from you to understand it better and to try to implement. So I think the world is your oyster as far as Benton County of what we want to be, and it's going to be a lot of feedback from the community, and I am learning and respecting Oregon values, learning a lot about Oregon law. A few things are different here from back in New York. And I think we're going to have some really exciting projects ahead. We have a lot of infrastructure projects. We have a new crisis center, a new courthouse, an emergency operations center. All of these are going to need to be built. And so we're going to be building things. And so folks who are listening, you know, Corvallis in the surrounding areas, it's going to look a little different. And I think that that's something that's going to be really good.
Well, how many new buildings total does that include?
Oh, one, two, three. I think we're doing three brand new buildings. And then we're shifting people around. We have a children and families building that we purchased. So we're going to be moving folks in from a leased space into a much more modern space for people who are going to, the kids who are going to be using that facility. And of course, mental health is one of our biggest priorities because it riddles our criminal justice system. And, you know, as you know, we have this correctional facility that I am also very committed to building. And so that's why we are going to be establishing a fund and starting to save our money, the county. So when we go back out to bond, we're going to be able to say to the people of Benton County, we saved this much. We need this much because I have visited the correctional facility 3 times. It is not a good place. It has a lot of problems, and it's not sustainable. So we will have to build a correction facility. And what that looks like, what scale, that remains to be seen.
Oh, you haven't decided how big it would be or...
We have lots of studies. We are still going to do more assessments. And most importantly, the first action is that we're going to put some money away, Benton County, and every year, I don't know exactly how much, to start saving to build it.
What are some other projects you have on your forefront?
I mean, most of the work I have to do is to bring, once again, we talked about workplace of choice. So I want to get everybody to a good wage so they feel good about it. I want to look at our workforce and look at our EDI assessments. EDI is equity, diversity, and inclusion. It's very, very important. You want a lot of different folks at the table when you make decisions. You want people who have different cultural backgrounds. You want different ages, different gender, to help you with your decision-making. You know, I'm only one person, right? But right now, I'd like it to reflect more of the county, but also those who are kind of disenfranchised, and that we're thinking about these decisions we make, whether we build a building, launch a program. I think it just helps with our decision-making, but it's also what our younger workforce wants and needs. And I think that that's something that we need to grow. Equity, I don't know if anybody knows what equity is. The only way I can describe it is we should be able to look at a map and look at the services that we provide, the buildings that are around us, and it is an equitable place to live. This is a very expensive county to live in. We have to look at other ways to get a middle class, working class, the poor, those are unhoused, to be able to live here. And right now, we just don't have that. And I know the governor's working hard on it. And we really have to be a lot more proactive in that area.
So if it were an issue like rent control, is that something that you would have a hand in?
I don't know. I think that has to be done on the state level. But the nice thing about Oregon, what I've noticed is we are asked a lot of feedback as administrators of what we believe it should look like. And that is kind of through associations, but also like directly from the governor's office. And I mean, I've personally met the governor 3 times. I've only been here since October. This is a much smaller state than when I came from. And I think that that's incredible. And I find like all the state delegation, I've met them so many times already.
Not like that in New York?
No, I'm just incredibly impressed that you can pick up the phone and talk to the Speaker of the House. There's a lot of availability. So that's just another observation coming from New York, that it's fairly easy to get to your elected officials.
On that note, if people wanted to get in touch with you and maybe give you feedback, or if they had ideas for projects, what is the best way that the public could reach out to you?
They can come by the Kalapulia building in Corvallis.
And that's on Southwest Technology Loop.
They can find me online. There's a little bio. They took a nice picture of me. There's an email right there. I also have my cell phone on my business card. And I'm happy to get a cup of coffee and discuss any issue that comes to them. Some constituents have. And, I again invite me to your pancake breakfast or the next meeting, and I would love to there. Just give me time to learn and listen, because, again, I'm still very much learning this job.
Rachel certainly has a lot of experience, but as a new resident of Oregon and Benton County, it does help to grow the perspective, as she said, by meeting people in the community, really getting a feel for what the needs are, understanding this grand new place that is different from her background in New York, working with a lot of different politicians there. We're speaking with Rachel McEnany. You're listening to the Benton County Public Podcast. And as I record this, it is a very nice morning. It's early March, and we are at an elevation where there is actual snow on the ground. We have a very happy dog just in front of us.
I think you should tell people we were stuck in the snow.
We almost got stuck in the snow.
I think we need to be honest with your listeners.
But we weren't stuck. We were almost stuck.
How many times did you get out and push the car?
Twice.
Okay.
But okay. There was never a point where it's like, oh my gosh, we're stuck. We just kept moving. We Oregonians learn to adapt.
Okay.
And I wanted to prove it in that moment, and I did.
Yep.
Because the car is operational and ready to drive on the road. So it would seem that there's a real challenge, especially in this day and age. You've got a new age entering the workforce. You've got a lot of the workforce retiring. We have a global pandemic that really messed up the routine of a lot of people's workflow, or even people's ability to focus and be present at work. So in lieu of a lot of that, it sounds like you have some challenges facing you as far as developing a good workforce and one that can be retained.
Sure. So what we're finding in general, and I want to give a little shout out to the sheriff's office, for example. I came from an organization that was down 150 cops. We know what's going on in Portland. We know what's happening in the Oregon State Police. Right now, we have no vacancies in the sheriff's department. We have sheriff deputies that are moving into Benton County. Why? We have to learn things from this sheriff because he is obviously leading a team that it's working and the morale is better than ever.
And they have no vacancies.
That is something that should be looked at from a very larger national level. And I think that starts with leadership, right? So I think that is an interesting place to be. The other thing that I think we're still trying to understand is those who used to work in public service or government, they would do it for a pension, right? Pensions barely exist anymore. I am competing with the private sector in other counties, and people are really looking at the bottom line of, I'm going to make a dollar more an hour, but I'm going to drive an extra 50 miles. But the point is, I'm going to make a dollar more an hour. We need people to look at a whole package of what's going to happen and what happens. Government used to be the job of stability. Now we have folks who are going to work 2-3 years and they move on. Sometimes they'll go to another government entity, the state, the county. So we really need to study that and why people are moving around as much. Sometimes it's just, it is the reality. That's the trend. The vacancy rate up in government in general in all jobs is down. Some folks want telecommuting. Some want just the opposite. They want to be around a group and they want to collaborate and they want to be creative and they want to be in the same room. So there's got to be some flexibility there. And I think as an employer, that is a real challenge. So Benton County, we have grown about 100 employees all in the mental health field because the demand is there. That's where the trend is going. That particular area, yes, we are down on vacancies. We lose folks after a few years. We train them and they move on. We need to figure that out. Do I have an
answer
today?
It's probably a really difficult job.
It's a very difficult
job. Being a mental health worker.
Absolutely. But at the same time, it is so essential. I mean, that is where we really look at addiction and we look at our issues that we see when we go out to dinner and we see those who are unhoused and we want to do things and we want to look at it. And a lot of it is through the lens of mental health. So I think that that's going to really drive a lot of my attention in the next year, in my first year, as we move forward. I'm also really looking forward to going to the fair. I've met the fairground board. They're awesome. I'm really looking forward to seeing what kind of folks come out regionally to our fair and what that looks like. I'm just really, I think the community itself is really engaged, and I'm really hoping that more and more people will actually come out to community meetings. But at the same time, in government, more people are comfortable going online, and there's a real apathy there. And how do we bring that back? You know, we're in a presidential year. More people should be voting this year. They usually do. What is that going to look like? I'm really excited to see what vote by mail looks like here. That is not something I'm used to. That I think is also something that is I really want to learn from and see what works here and what doesn't work here. I think it's really important from a transparency standpoint that hopefully folks like you and other ones that they feel really comfortable about their vote, that it's secure. And I want to really push out some videos and work and give some tours to people so they do feel comfortable with this process. There's a lot of level of distrust in government in general. And local government, we're the closest to the person. We can help you on a lot more level than the feds can. We're into tax season, so everybody doesn't like government very much. I get it. But it's kind of our opportunity to be there and serve you. So as much as we want to go remote, and we got to go digital, and we got to go to portals because it makes sense, there's still that person who wants to be able to talk to someone if they don't, they want to talk about their property tax, or they just want to talk to a human being. So balancing that, like I talked about earlier, is those are the type of things that we need to do. But mainly we have to serve those in need. So
government can work and it should work. It just boils down to the right people showing up and being in the right positions. And on that note, if you out there in the listening audience are interested in working for Benton County, you can visit our website at bentoncountyor.gov. There's a tab there that says careers. And at any time, there's some openings happening within Benton County.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a lot of different areas to go into. And whether you have your entire career at Benton County or, like I discussed earlier, it's a 2-3 year gig. I didn't know I was going to be working in government for over 20, 25 years. But it really is a place where you can make a difference. You will make decisions. A lot of jobs, you don't really get to make those type of decisions. We're never going to make a profit. There's not a lot of bonuses out there. But the real key is that personal satisfaction and that mission that you don't get a lot unless you're in the nonprofit world or in government. If people wanted to go into work like this, it is absolutely incredibly gratifying. I come from a family of a mom who was an ER x-ray trauma technician. My father was a social worker, school teacher, and then a state representative. I think government works. I think it's an area that, you know, we may not make the most money in the world, but we certainly are making a difference.
Rachel McEnany is the county administrator for Benton County. She was hired in October of last year and has a number of projects on the horizon and was kind enough to join us today on the Benton County Public Podcast. And you can find out more about Benton County government. Check out their updated website. It's bentoncountyor.gov. And on that note, we have a feature that was recorded in February, and the website team received recognition for their efforts.
The Corvallis Celtic Festival presents a fundraiser concert for this summer's festival. On Monday, March 25th, see Boston-based fiddler Hanukkah Castle. Her take on music from the Isle of Skye and Cape Breton adds Americana grooves and musical innovations. Hanukkah's music is a blend of the contemporary and traditional, described by the Boston Globe as exuberant and rhythmic, somehow wild and innocent, and an irresistible playfulness. Hanukkah Castle and Band perform March 25th at the Unitarian Fellowship in Corvallis. Tickets $20 in advance from Ticket Tomato or $25 at the door. Visit CorvallisCelticFestival.org for more information. Fiddler Hanukkah Castle performs March 25th in a benefit for the Corvallis Celtic Festival. CorvallisCelticFestival.org.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard Sunday afternoons at 1 and Monday evenings at 5 here on KORC, listener-supported community radio in Corvallis. Home sharing, a sustainable solution to the affordable housing crisis, is the theme of an event scheduled for Thursday, April 4th, from 7 p.m. to 8:30 at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library. This event is being co-sponsored by the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition's Housing Action Team and HomeShare Oregon. Are you concerned about the affordable housing crisis?
Are you a homeowner, or do you know one who is on a fixed income or is mortgage burdened? Do you care about sustainability and community building? Debbie Friedlander, co-leader of the Housing Action Team, will open this program with a brief overview of how home sharing is a sustainable solution to the affordable housing crisis, socially, economically, and environmentally. She will be followed by Judy Smith, who is the program director of HomeShare Oregon, who is going to explain how her organization is expanding access to affordable housing through home sharing, a direct way to prevent housing instability, foreclosure, and homelessness. Smith will be joined by two additional panelists, Charlotte Fleming and James Dirksen, by the way, not affiliated with the property management company in town and a different spelling on the last name. Both of these panelists are homeowners who have shared their homes through HomeShare Oregon. Together, the panel will respond to questions from the audience. Friedlander hopes this event will help normalize the idea of home sharing, saying it's a common sense way to address the need for more affordable housing. Doors for this event will open at 6:45 p.m. if you wish to come early and network with fellow community members. There will also be a special prize drawing at the close of the program. The public is encouraged and invited to be a part of this exploration and conversation. Home sharing, a sustainable solution to the affordable housing crisis. That's scheduled for Thursday, April 4th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library. The event is co-sponsored by the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition's Housing Action Team and HomeShare Oregon. There's more information online at sustainablecorvallis.org or call 541-230-1237. This is KORC.
You're listening to KORC News, Music and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre with your Corvallis City meetings for the week of March 25th, 2024. On Tuesday, March 26th at 4:30 p.m., the Climate Action Advisory Board CAB meeting will be held virtually and in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. For details on how to join the meeting virtually, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, March 27th at 5 p.m., the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force meeting will be held at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for details on how to join the virtual meeting. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
You're listening to KORC. This is listener-supported community radio in Corvallis. This is Dan Krall in the Southtown studio, and I am joined today by A.V. Meadows of a collective of artists. Their acronym is NOST, N-O-S-T. What does that stand for?
Hey, Dan, thanks for asking. NOST stands for Northside Open Studios Tour. We're having our second annual appearance this coming April, April 20th and 21st in North Corvallis.
So what is NOST or N-O-S-T? From what I understand, it's artists opening up their home and showing off their art.
Well, one of the biggest things we want to relay to the community is that we believe that we can create the sort of world and community that we want to live in. And we think the best way to do that is through opening up our homes and talking about our art and process.
I did not have a chance to go on this last year, but I remember hearing about it. How did last year's event go?
It exceeded our expectations. We were expecting, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had about 40 or 50 people to come through? And we stopped counting at 200 people coming through my studio alone. And all the participating studios last year had that amount of numbers of people.
And that this event is coming up on Saturday, April 20th, and Sunday, April 21st.
Yeah, this year we went up to 2 days rather than one, and it's April 20th and 21st with 16 local Corvallis artists and over 20 youth artists participating this year as well. And it will be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on both days.
Super cool. Now, I understand you have a website. Does this website have a map of all the houses that will be on this tour?
We will have an updated map, yes. We have a website, and our website is www.nost-art.com.
What kind of art do you do?
Thanks for asking. I am a ceramic artist, and I make whimsical, lovable, slightly creepy ceramic insects.
Cool. Do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's www.avmeadows.com.
That's A-V-I-E meadows.com.
Yeah.
What are some of the other art mediums that folks can expect to see on the tour? That is Saturday, April 20th and Sunday, April 21st.
You can expect every single type of art you can imagine. We have beautiful mosaic stained glass, fiber arts, weaving, 2D, collage, jewelry, mixed media, encaustic, wood turning, everything you can think of.
What about things like film art or audio art, any of that type of art on the tour?
Yeah, we do have a photographer on the tour, and I'm not sure this year about video art, but that's a good suggestion to look for future years.
You can always find more information at the website nost-art.com. And we should mention that proceeds from this event are actually benefiting Vina Moses, a local charity here in Corvallis.
Yeah, we're really excited about that this year, too. Every artist will donate a portion of their sales directly to Vina Moses Center, where emergency assistance is provided to people going through times of hardship. And you can learn more about them. There's a link on our website to Vina Moses, or you can go to the Vina Moses website directly.
And this would seem a great way to build community, as you mentioned earlier, not just opening your home to potential strangers, but sharing your very personal art. Of course, it's made public as it becomes a work of art, but this is a great way to bring the community together and probably spark people's interest in art.
Yeah, you know, oftentimes when we talk about our art, it helps to open the door for conversations that can be vulnerable and life-giving. And so we just find that sharing our art with the community is a great way to have a conversation with people we might not normally ever talk to.
A.V. Meadows is one of the coordinators of the second annual Northside Open Studio Tour. That is an artist-led effort that will encourage the public to explore home studios. This two-day event is going to be Saturday, April 20th, Sunday, April 21st, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and more information is online. I'll let A.V. give the website, and then we'll get back to the music.
Yeah, again, that website is www.nost-art.com. Thank you, Dan.
You're listening to KORC, streaming at korcfm.com.
The Corvallis Celtic Festival presents a fundraiser concert for this summer's festival. On Monday, March 25th, see Boston-based fiddler Hanneke Castle. Her take on music from the Isle of Skye and Cape Breton adds Americana grooves and musical innovations. Hanneke's music is a blend of the contemporary and traditional, described by the Boston Globe as exuberant and rhythmic, somehow wild and innocent, and an irresistible playfulness. Hanneke Castle and band perform March 25th at the Unitarian Fellowship in Corvallis. Tickets $20 in advance from Ticket Tomato or $25 at the door. Visit CorvallisCelticFestival.org for more information. Fiddler Hanneke Castle performs March 25th in a benefit for the Corvallis Celtic Festival. CorvallisCelticFestival.org.
Thank you.
This is Dan Krall. I am currently recording at the top of the Benton County Courthouse, and I am making my way up to the attic space. I am walking up a very narrow wooden staircase. You can hear a little bit of electronic interference. We are near some cell reception towers, which is causing that. We do apologize for that. We are joined by Levon Atwood. He is a facilities tech for Benton County Public Works. Thanks for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We are at the top of the courthouse in a room with wooden walls, standing by a massive crank setup. Why don't you tell us what we're looking at?
Right now, what we're looking at is the clock up in the clock tower for the Benton County Courthouse. It's the original clock mechanism. You can see the clock faces on all four sides of the building. And it's not ticking, but it is actually still running.
We are walking around this device, which is a life-size device, about the size of myself or Levon here.
Yes.
E. Howard and Company, Boston, Massachusetts, is the manufacturer. And yes, we do see a slow rotation of this chain.
Yes. This used to be a weight and pendulum system. In fact, you can see some of the weights in the corner here.
Are those made of steel?
Yes. And they decided to change it out because otherwise somebody would have to come up here regularly. I believe it was every couple days they would have to come up here, and they'd have to change the weights back and forth. And so it became like kind of a part-time job just tending the clock. And so they changed it out. And they put now everything runs off of this little, basically like a hobby motor. And it shows how well geared everything is, that all of this big life-size machinery is run off of this little motor here.
How often does one have to come in and maintain this?
I try to come up here at least once every couple weeks. I mean, I like to get up here more, but I just don't have the time. And so I get up here and oil all of the mechanisms and everything. And then, of course, there's changing the clock on, you know, changing for spring forward and fall back and all that type of stuff. And also just kind of keep an eye on it. And it can be a little finicky because, you know, sometimes it doesn't ring when you say, oh, yeah, it's going to ring right now. And then it doesn't.
Separate from the clock itself was the OSU fight song played on a carillon.
Yes. The carillon, it's basically kind of like a automatic player piano. It has a scroll that has all the little holes and everything that are punched in there for at certain increments that strike certain keys, you know, kind of like a music box. And we have a whole bunch of different songs and stuff that we were able to load up, but right now we just have the Beaver fight song for kind of local civic pride and all that type of thing.
And that plays how often?
Three times a day is my understanding. It's 8 a.m., at noon, and at 5 p.m.
And there are other choices of songs you could play, but it's kind of hard to change out the device that determines different songs.
Yeah, I haven't really messed with it before. It's one of those things where I'd have to kind of try to figure it out, and I'm a little leery to go poking at it and find out, oh, I just broke the piece or whatever. And
that's old technology.
Yeah, and plus also a lot of it really comes down to just not having the time, you know, kind of one of those things where every time I mean to do something like put some Christmas music or something like that up, but then, you know, other things keep popping up, you know, that kind of unfortunately take a little higher priority.
Have you ever had to do any major repairs to any of this equipment?
I haven't had to do anything major. I know that right before I got here, there was an issue with the cable that runs that rings the bell. It had broken, and so they replaced that. You can see that the cable looks like it's a lot newer than everything else in the building. And then I've been kind of trying to tinker with the ringing mechanism. For some reason, it rings on like the 43-minute mark of the hour instead of the half hour. Something is shifted there. And then also trying to keep it so that it rings on the hour, and sometimes things kind of move and all that. So it's like a lot of little bent nails and things like that kind of shift.
And how long has this setup existed here in the courthouse?
Since they built it, which it was built in 1888.
Levon Atwood is a facilities tech for Benton County Public Works and was kind enough to show us up here at the very top of the Benton County Courthouse as we look at the clock tower device that chimes the bell, and we also had a chance to hear the OSU fight song, which has been programmed in since 1991, to our knowledge. And up here, we do have a bell that used to serve as the fire warning bell, correct? This is about the size of the Liberty Bell, if you look at it. It's a very big, heavy bell. Are we able to get a recording of maybe a chime or two on that?
Yes.
Or, okay. Levon is going to chime the bell that used to serve as an emergency warning of a fire. It would probably be quite an effort to move this out of here, so I figure they just let it stay put. This is no light bell. And this on the side says Naylor Vickers and Company. This is number 890. Oh, wait, what does it say?
Sheffield.
Naylor Vickers and Company, Sheffield.
1859. If you like, I could even force this to ring.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Okay.
Do you have to go upstairs?
I do.
Okay.
So.
Okay, you ready?
Ready. I understand you also changed the flag.
Correct. We have to change the flag every 6 months or whenever it becomes as needed if it becomes damaged. And then also we have to raise and lower the flag for certain events, you know, if somebody passes away or anything like that. And so in order to do that, we have to wear the proper PPE and everything. And we climb up to the very top. There's a ladder that takes you up there, and then you tie off, and there's a hatch that you have to climb out onto the roof. And in order to raise and lower the flag, I can sit inside and, you know, do what I need to do to raise and lower it. But then to change it, I have to climb out onto the roof and stand there in order to reach and change things out. There's a clasp that's at the base of the flagpole that you have to release in order to get the flag to pass through and everything.
And the flag itself is above the bell tower.
Correct.
Yes. So if you drive past the Benton County Courthouse, you look at the flag at the very tip top. This is the man who has to change the flag every 6 months or lower it to half mast.
Correct. Yep. It's part of the job.
Is it fun being on the roof at that height?
The view is great, but it can be a little spooky. The mount and the dismount, climbing in and out of there can be a little, I have to kind of psych myself up for it, but it's once you get up there, it's a great view. And as long as it's a nice sunny day, you can see Mount Hood and stuff like that, so it's nice.
Levon Atwood, I'd like to thank you again for your time today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Before we left this upper level, I was able to convince Levon to turn on the carillon, the mechanism that ordinarily plays the OSU fight song, off of a paper script, which then programs this automatic playing of the song. I asked Levon to play a few keys, just a minimal sequence.
Thank you.
Thank you.